Well, this is a two-part session, and the second part might be a little bit harder to look at than, not look at, but listen to than the first part, because the second part we'll get into Cox 1, Cox 2 ratios, but we won't get into it too awful much. What I try and do with this session is we have lots of drugs to choose from now, but we don't have much basis for selecting among them. And so what I'm going to do is just share with you an internist slash clinical pharmacologist perspective as to how you might make sense out of the drugs that we have out there available. And so I call it getting along with the Cox is because in some respects that's what we're trying to do. Just a second. Don't you tell me you're not going to work. Behave yourself. Much better. Okay. We're doing a much better job in controlling pain in both human and veterinary medicine. There's lots of reasons for doing it. In my mind, one of the most important reasons for doing it is to solidify that veterinary client-patient relationship. And I don't think that there's too many more things that will endear a client to you than paying particular attention to the control of pain in their pet. But we know it goes far beyond that now. We've recognized for a while now that pain doesn't do too awful much good. In human medicine, they've demonstrated that you can actually decrease morbidity and mortality if you break that the anxiousness that's associated with the lack of control of pain and the sleeplessness that's associated with that. You will decrease hospital costs as well. And, of course, we know now that uncontrolled pain leads to marked immune suppression, certainly gastrointestinal upset, and cardiac disturbances such as hypertension and tachycardia. And if you don't believe that, then you just pay attention to an animal that's intraoperative that doesn't have any analgesic support above and beyond the gas anesthetic. Those animals will feel pain quite a bit, and there will be cardiovascular responses because of that. But in the last 10 years, there's been a more mitigating reason that has emerged for control of appropriate pain, and especially the preemptive use. And that's what the body does when it perceives unrelieved pain. And this is beyond the conscious perception. It's now the subconscious perception. And we know now that nociopathic pain or nociceptive pain, pain that is interpreted at the level of the nociceptor and then signals move up and down the brain and spinal cord, can be converted to neuropathic pain, which is pain that is characterized by words such as hyperalgesia, a wind-up phenomena where the animal or the person now feels the pain at a much lower threshold than they would have, say, before the pain became neuropathic, and more intensely. It doesn't let up. Example here, the probably best example is the phantom pain, the observation that a person or an animal can continue to feel pain even though the inciting cause of the pain has been removed. But we know now that the spinal cord will undergo morphologic functional changes up and down the spinal cord and in the brain if it perceives unrelieved pain. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the receptors that do that, but this is the biggest reason that we can think of that should now cause us to be more aggressive preemptively for the control of pain. Just a couple of the mediators of pain I just wanted you to recognize, or I just wanted to make a statement here, because of course we're going to talk about the non-steroidals, and I've asterisked the mediators of pain that non-steroidals are going to target. But here, of course, is one of the problems, because it's not just the eicosanoids, which come from the cell membranes, but it's also the preformed mediators such as histamine and serotonin that occur with mast cell degranulation. Then there's the peptides, the kinins and substance P and related materials. And then there must be hundreds of cytokines, including interleukins, tumor necrosis factor. We have to add to that the metalloproteinases, and there are good metalloproteinases and bad metalloproteinases. And then there are hormones that get in on the action. And so this is a very lengthy list of mediators that can be responsible for the transmission of pain from the nociceptor to the spinal cord. And then we have to add to that another host of mediators responsible for central transmission: catecholamines, aspartate, glutamate, GABA, which is GABA aminobutyric acid, nitric oxide. The list is comprehensive, and it is no small wonder that it is very difficult for you guys to control pain effectively. And when we look at nonsteroidals, they are such a tiny part of the pathophysiology of pain. And then to complicate factors even more, it's easy to understand why we have so few drugs to control pain when we recognize that these mediators that control pain are also tightly interwoven with endogenous anti-inflammatory mediators. And I've listed these here. These are mediators in the body whose job it is to control inflammation. And we've not really recognized that these existed until we used drugs that targeted the inflammatory mediators and recognized that sometimes we were making things worse. So this simply complicates the efforts trying to come up with a reasonable, effective drug or set of drugs for controlling pain. We'll talk a little bit about the lipoxins, but for each class of mediators over here, prostaglandins, metalloproteinases, leukotrienes, there are good mediators that we want to try and avoid the inhibition of. And that includes the cytokines, too. Interleukin 10 and 4 are endogenous anti-inflammatory cytokines. So what does that mean? Well, we have to complicate this even further when we look at the receptors and the channels that are involved with controlling pain. And I just wanted to draw to your attention two groups. The first group, because we are using drugs that target these receptors. The second group, because these are on the horizon. The N-methyl-D-aspartate receptors, the NMDA receptors, these are up and down the spinal cord, especially in the dorsal horn. We don't know too awful much about them, except they don't seem to help us out too awful much. They tend to be more problematic than helpful. In fact, what they seem to do is modulate endogenous analgesic responses. In other words, they will make opioids not work as well. And when you look at their role in neuropathic pain, among them is the induction of opioid tolerance. It's one of the reasons that animals or people will require increasingly high doses of opioids to control pain. But on top of that, these NMDA receptors are also responsible in part for the hyperalgesia and the wind-up phenomena that I talked about a little bit earlier. And it turns out that these guys also seem to interact with glutamate. Well, glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter, but this guy has some problems. It is very neurotoxic, and if too much of it gets inside the neuron, you'll see neurotoxicity primarily because of calcium fluxes. And so that's not a particularly good thing. The other thing that I just wanted to remind you of, but let you know, there's all sorts of neat things going on in human medicine and, of course, veterinary medicine ultimately. There's a whole class of channels now that have been recognized to be involved with pain. These are called the transient receptor potential channels. These are voltage-dependent sodium channels, a brand new group of sodium channels, unlike the ones that are targeted by our local analgesics such as lidocaine. And it turns out that these guys are the ones that set the threshold at the level of the nociceptor. They are the ones that set the sensitivity. There are at least 9 receptor subtypes, each one of them responsible for its own noxious stimuli. One will be responsible for burns, one of them will be responsible for acids, one of them for bases. It's just absolutely amazing what's going on out there. But the nice thing about this gives us a whole new class of analgesics that might be targeting the level of the nociceptor. So as we look at the drugs that we can reach for, we're going to see even more classes add the armamentarium as we go forward. And it gives, it encourages the idea of combination analgesic therapy. Of course, that's something that we all do. But as we look at the different receptors, the different channels, the different mediators, it makes perfect sense that combination analgesic therapy may be important for some patients. And so with that in mind, I've just listed some of the classes of drugs that we use. We've traditionally referred to them as centrally acting and peripherally acting, but increasingly we're recognizing that opioids act peripherally and nonsteroidals act centrally, and so this classification is somewhat false. What I did want to do is just take a second and talk about 3 classes or 3 drugs that aren't really nonsteroidals, but I didn't know where else to fit them in, and my second hour is too full already, so I'm going to just sneak them in right here and just point out a couple of things. Ketamine, we've known for a while that ketamine by itself is not a particularly good analgesic, but increasingly veterinarians are using it as part of a constant rate infusion combination with things like morphine and or lidocaine and or fentanyl. Well, it turns out that ketamine is a very effective NMDA receptor antagonist, and so it is being used in human medicine as well as veterinary medicine quite successfully for controlling acute and chronic pain. And one of the things that I didn't mention before, but in human medicine, they've demonstrated demonstrated that if one fails intraoperatively to control the perception of pain, even though the patient is not awake, that pain within 30 to 60 minutes can be converted to chronic pain that shows up 6 months later. And so the idea of using an NMDA receptor antagonist NMDA receptors have been associated with that advent of chronic pain following an acute insult. So increasingly, the use of NMDA receptor antagonists intraoperatively is appealing. And so that's what ketamine is all about. It's been used quite effectively in people. Actually, it's been used orally to control cancer pain in combination with morphine. The problem with that, of course, is the CNS side effects. So if you've been using ketamine intraoperatively and maybe immediately postoperatively, there's a rational reason for that. For the outpatient basis, one of the things that you might think about doing is using amantadine. Now, this is a drug that was approved for use to treat Parkinson's disease. It's anticholinergic in its efficacy. It is an NMDA receptor antagonist, and as such, it might be useful for controlling, again, that central sensitization and the conversion of acute to chronic pain. It's been used in combination with opioids, especially for acute rescue. It can be used with nonsteroidals, we've done it, and it can be used with tramadol, which I'll talk about next. It's available in convenient dosing forms in the United States. The dose is 3 mg per kg once a day orally, so it's a relatively convenient dosing regimen. It can be used in dogs and cats. The side effects are typical of anticholinergic side effects, so tachycardia and those other sort of things, but it seems to be relatively safe. And the real quick story I'll tell is we controlled an animal that we could not get fentanyl patches for anymore by prescribing that animal a combination of amantadine and tramadol. And that dog, which had a limb amputation because of osteosarc that had metastasized, did quite well on that combination for about 3 months. So this is the third one, and I know that you know tramadol, but there are just a couple of things that I wanted to say about it, because this is a drug that we can use in combination with nonsteroidals. In fact, you can purchase tramadol with acetaminophen, which is kind of a nonsteroidal, so it can be used very effectively. It is a non-opioid non-steroidal. It is orally bioavailable. It is an agonist at mu1 receptors. Well, that's what fentanyl and codeine and the other pure agonists are all about. And so because of that, we see some of the opioid-like effects. But it also has a second mechanism of action, and that is inhibition of the uptake of mediators such as serotonin, epinephrine, norepinephrine. Well, that's the same thing that our behavior modifying drugs do. And we've known for some time that behavior modifying drugs are useful in people for control of chronic pain, especially that is neurologically associated. Well, tramadol does it all by itself. So all by itself, it's a combination analgesic. I just want you to be aware that the metabolite produces the majority of the efficacy. Why do I want you to be aware of that? Because to my knowledge, nobody studied tramadol in the cat yet, and it seems to be very safe, but I wouldn't be surprised if you have to use higher doses in the cat compared to the dog to get effective analgesia. We're not there yet, but it does need to be studied because of this metabolite issue. Side effects are very typical of opioids, although you probably won't see respiratory depression. You'll see a ceiling effect much the same as you do with buprenorphine. However, be aware of two things. As with any opioid, if you use it long term, the animal will develop tolerance to it. And anytime an animal or a person develops tolerance to something, if you suddenly discontinue that drug, you can anticipate signs of withdrawal as well. So if you do use tramadol, I would not suddenly discontinue the drug if I've had an animal on it longer than a couple of days to a week. I would probably taper the dose. And the second reason for doing that is because it does block the uptake of these neurotransmitters. And anytime you mess with the brain, you never want to do anything suddenly. You want to back off gently so the brain has time to accommodate. The other thing to be aware of is because this drug does allow accumulation of serotonin, then you may have issues with what is called the serotonin syndrome if you combine it with other drugs or compounds that block the uptake of serotonin. What am I talking about here? Well, S-adenosylmethionine, behavior-modifying drugs, St. John's wort, there are a number of drugs out there that also block the uptake of serotonin. And in human medicine, the serotonin syndrome has been characterized by CNS signs such as seizures, tremors, other CNS active signs in people that have received these combinations. So be careful about this. The last thing I'm going to tell you about tramadol is I think that the dose is too low. If you go to Mark Papich, that did study this drug in dogs, and to get therapeutic concentrations, you need about 5 mg per kg every 8 to 12 hours, maybe even every 6 to 8 hours. So bear in mind that the dose that's out there, I think it's about 2 mg per kg, is probably too low for dogs, and you need to up that dose a little bit. You can use it with acetaminophen. It's very effective in that scenario. The only thing is you've got to be so careful about counseling clients about not using it, the combination in cats. You can use tramadol in cats, and they may not understand that the acetaminophen cannot be used in cats. And what scares me is even if you counsel that client, well, the client's kids are going to be seeing you using the tramadol with acetaminophen in the dog, and they might just make the mistake of thinking it's okay in cats. So I'm just real uncomfortable or just concerned about the combination, the mistaken use of the acetaminophen in cats. And I don't know how to get around that except counsel your clients really well. Tramadol, you're probably aware of this, is now available in a generic preparation, and it can be very cost effective. All right, so now let's move to nonsteroidals, which is why we're here this afternoon. Variety of uses for nonsteroidals, among them control of pain, and we'll talk about control of pain as our primary target, and we will include in that a little bit osteoarthritis, but here's the point that I'm going to make a couple of times. We will see that these drugs do lots of things. These drugs are not what I call crisp drugs when you talk about controlling pain. They do many, many things to the physiology of the patient. And as we go down the list of causes of pain, and of course this clearly is just a short list, there are pain causes here such as GDV, thrombosis, trauma, where the animal's body is going to be doing lots of things to try and make it better. Well, one of the ways that the animal's body tries to make itself better is through prostaglandins, and we're going to be targeting those with these nonsteroidals. So I'm going to encourage you to be discriminatory about the types of pains that you use nonsteroidals for, because my concern is that we are going to disrupt normal physiology. I don't think anything is smarter than the body, and I try real hard not to disrupt what the body's trying to do to heal itself. And so I'll make that point again intermittently, but the bottom line is I'd rather see the use of these drugs, and they're very good drugs, for control of pain in the normal, healthy animal that's undergoing an elective type of procedure where I don't have to worry about physiologic responses being attenuated by the use of the nonsteroidal. And we'll see that as we go through. So there's lots of nonsteroidals out there. There's probably 60 or 70 nonsteroidals that veterinarians can use, that clients can get over the counter. In the past, I had to memorize their categorization based on chemical structure, which was absolutely worthless because other than being a good opportunity for a multiple choice exam question, you can't predict efficacy of these drugs based upon chemical structure. The example here are the profens, the ketoprofen, ibuprofen, and carprofen. Carprofen is much more safe, much safer than ketoprofen. Ibuprofen, you can kill a dog relatively easy, and yet they're all in the same class of drugs. So you've got to be careful about classifying these based upon chemical structure. And as I said, it's probably not worth it. We're going to talk about acetaminophen just very briefly. It is classified sort of as a nonsteroidal, but its mechanism of action is not exactly the same, so we'll point that out. But it can be a very effective analgesic in dogs. If you're looking for an alternative to nonsteroidals, it can be very effective, and we've stopped using it because of our concern with cats. So all of these drugs share a common mechanism of action, and that is they're going to target cyclooxygenases. The problem with these drugs, one of the problems, especially with the traditional drugs, is remember that these drugs target cyclooxygenases, but this really starts back up here. What happens is anytime the cell membrane is damaged, phospholipases cause the release of arachidonic acid. Now, that is the major fatty acid in mammalian membranes. This arachidonic acid serves as a substrate for at least two groups of enzymes, the cyclooxygenases, which make prostaglandins, and the lipoxygenases, which make leukotrienes. Now, there's another one here that I don't show you on this slide, and that's platelet activating factor. Now, just as an aside, if you're a person that believes in omega fatty acids, remember what they do, or what high fish diets do, is they replace arachidonic acid with a fatty acid that, when converted to prostaglandins, is not nearly as inflammatory. And so that's why we use the omega fatty acids. We're getting at the problem a little bit different way. One of the problems with the nonsteroidals is if you block the cyclooxygenases and you don't make prostaglandins, all this arachidonic acid has to go somewhere, and the where it goes is it will be metabolized by lipoxygenases to leukotrienes. Human asthmatics for the longest time could not take these nonsteroidals because their asthma would get worse. Why? Because the lung is chock full of leukotrienes, and what they were doing is just making more leukotrienes whenever they took a traditional nonsteroidal. Now that's changed a little bit because the newer nonsteroidals are not as bad. Why? Well, as we go forward and we talk about the effects of these nonsteroidals, let me remind you that they all share not only a common mechanism of action, but they also share pharmacologic effects. And these effects are dose dependent. Why is this important? Well, if I'm trying to control pain, and that pain is associated with inflammation, then I'm going to have to use the highest dose I can to try and control the pain, and that puts the patient at risk. Now, if I'm just trying to control fever, and I'll strongly discourage you from doing that chemically, fever is one of the few mechanisms the body has to protect itself, but if you are convinced that chemical control of fever is the way to go, that takes a much lower dose compared to controlling pain or controlling inflammation. All of these effects, all the things that we want, are going to be caused by the same prostaglandin. That's prostaglandin of the E series, and in a couple of minutes we will see that it's largely COX-2, but not exclusively so. So that's a good target. But their use is limited by safety, and that's true even with the newer nonsteroidals, but not nearly as much as the traditional nonsteroidals. And of course, the biggest concern that we have, at least in dogs, is gastrointestinal ulceration. Dogs have been described as exquisitely sensitive to the GI side effects of nonsteroidals. I think that that's probably true compared to people, and so we have to be particularly careful. What about cats? Well, we've been so careful with these drugs in cats, I'm not sure that we have a real good handle as far as relative susceptibility to GI side effects of the cat compared to the dog. I would guess it's probably equal, but here's one thing that I am worried about. I think cats are more susceptible to the renal effects of these drugs, and we'll see that towards the end of the session. And so with cats, it's kidneys, and I'm not saying I'm not worried about the GI tract, but I'm certainly worried about the kidneys. And I'll worry about the kidneys in dogs as well. So this was from USA Today about 2005, and this is about the time that Vioxx was withdrawn off the market. And it's just a simple reminder. USA Today went back to their co-hosts and said, oh yeah, dogs have problems with these drugs as well. And it is a good reminder that these drugs do kill. The newer drugs are much safer than the older drugs, but they kill. And we'll see that as we go through. And because of that, we have to be careful. Okay, so what happened? Well, about a decade ago, maybe more, investigators messing with glucocorticoids recognized that a macrophage, that it had been activated by endotoxin, could have the prostaglandins that it made blocked by prednisone, by glucocorticoids. But if you took that same glucocorticoid and used it in the presence of platelets, the glucocorticoid would not impact those prostaglandins. So now we have a differential effect of glucocorticoids on prostaglandins, and that means, therefore, that there's probably at least two isoforms of the enzyme that is responsible for making prostaglandins, and sure enough, that is true. It turns out that there are at least two isoforms. The first one we're going to talk about is COX-2. The nice thing about pharmacologists is they do make naming a little bit easier, so we've got COX-1 and COX-2. COX-2 is the inducible prostaglandin, as was demonstrated in the macrophage. The macrophage was induced to make it. It is not something that we need necessarily constantly, and it is exemplified by those prostaglandins responsible for control of pain, fever, and inflammation. Well, I'm going to stop right here because when I was a resident, trying to figure out what prostaglandins did in the body was just enough to drive you bonkers. Every cell in the body, save red blood cells, makes prostaglandins. The easiest way to think about what prostaglandins do in the body is they protect. And if you think about an organ and what it might need from protection from, prostaglandins are probably responsible for part of that. But prostaglandins are also imbalanced, and we will see here in a couple of minutes that while you might have one prostaglandin that impairs hydrochloric acid, there might be another one that stimulates it. So it's a very finely balanced, it's intricately balanced in the body. And so we've got a prostaglandin that will cause one effect, and it's going to be offset by prostaglandins that cause the other effect. And if we disrupt that balance, we potentially get our patient in trouble. Well, inflammation is a protective mechanism. We don't need it all the time, but sometimes we need it, and it's one of the ways that the body can protect itself. We contrast COX-2 with COX-1. These are referred to as the constitutive prostaglandins, and they are responsible for basal metabolic homeostasis as we sit here. And the organs that I've got shown here, the GI tract, hemostasis, and the kidney, are the best examples of this balance between, it's called yin-yang, but the balance between stimulating and inhibiting of the prostaglandins. Well, once we figured out that there were two isoforms, it didn't take long for the companies to come up with ways to avoid the typical side effects associated with the traditional nonsteroidals. Because traditional nonsteroidals block everything, yep, they worked pretty well, but they were pretty toxic. So a little bit of work, and now we have, at least in human medicine, we have Celebrex and Vioxx, which has been taken off the market, and they are relatively selective for COX-2. Now, I try real hard to not say COX-2 selective, because what happened with carprofen when it was approved is we got caught. We thought these drugs were going to be absolutely safe because we weren't going to target COX-1. We were wrong, and so it's just a general reminder that none of these drugs are selective, none of them. They may target more COX-2 than COX-1, but you're always going to get some COX-1, and that should cause us to be extra careful. In veterinary medicine, we now have 5 of these drugs, and every manufacturer, appropriately so, is trying to get a piece of the nonsteroidal pie, which makes your job as a clinician more difficult trying to discriminate among them. Now, the pharmacologist in me is going to come out here. What is so neat about this is the differences between COX-1 and COX-2, and the ability of COX-2 to interface with these drugs has to do with 3 tiny amino acids. And what they do is they cause this isoform to form a little pocket in that protein so that the drug can insert itself in that little pocket. And that's the only difference between the two isoforms, just 3 little amino acids. All right, so what I'm going to do for the remainder of this first hour is share with you some information that should cause you to decide whether or not the use of these drugs is not only going to enhance safety, but you're still going to maintain efficacy. So if we largely target COX-2 and spare COX-1, is that a safe and effective way to use these drugs? Well, to answer that, the first thing I'm going to do is demonstrate that COX-2 is indeed the guy that we want to target. COX-2 is the bad guy. How is that proven? Well, first of all, it's largely gone in normal chondrocytes. So in the absence of inflammation, there's no COX-2. On the other hand, if there is disease that is associated with inflammation, it is markedly upregulated in just about any kind of arthritis that you might want to study. Investigators have taken knockout mice that don't have COX-2, and they don't mount a good inflammatory response. So all sorts of studies support the fact that COX-2 is the bad guy. Having said that, COX-1 does have some role in the inflammatory response, and that means, therefore, if you have a drug that targets both COX-1 and COX-2, that kind of drug might likely be a little bit more effective than a drug that only targets COX-2. So why do I make that statement? Because we're going to come back to Zubrin in a little bit. Zubrin will target COX-1, and theoretically, it might be more effective than our newer nonsteroidals. Well, that's not all. COX-2 does some other things that we're not particularly happy with. In the brain, it turns out that both COX-1 and COX-2 are constitutively expressed. Extremely intricate balance here, tightly regulated. COX-2 is the guy that is responsible for resetting the thermostat, so responsible for fever, and is responsible for transmission of pain up and down the spinal cord, and in fact is probably responsible for some of the hyperalgesia and wind-up phenomena that we talked about a little bit earlier. So it makes perfect sense that a nonsteroidal might be part of your combination analgesic modality. But look what else COX-2 does. It is responsible for the anorexia that characterizes chronic pain and inflammation, as well as the lethargy as well. So lots of bad things that COX-2 does. But that's not all. It turns out there are 2 things that came forward from people that were taking an aspirin a day to keep the myocardial infarction away. After about 2 decades of use, a little bit of epidemiological footwork revealed 2 things. First of all, these individuals had a decreased risk of Alzheimer's disease. In fact, within 2 years of therapy with aspirin, you'll see a decreased risk of Alzheimer's disease. It turns out that COX-2 is markedly upregulated in those areas of amyloid deposition, which characterizes Alzheimer's disease. Not only that, it's been associated with other senile demential diseases. COX-2 markedly potentiates glutamate. Glutamate is that excitatory neurotransmitter that I said once it gets inside the neuron causes neurotoxicity. So lots of reasons to potentially look at the role of COX-2 in senile dementia diseases. And it's one of two reasons that I take my aspirin every morning, and I think that it is probably going to be kicking in any day now. It hasn't quite kicked in yet, but if you're not taking your baby aspirin a day, you need to be thinking about it. The other reason is this. It turns out that those individuals also had a decreased incidence of colon cancer. And, of course, you've been using piroxicam now for some time to treat some tumors, especially transitional cell tumor, because of its ability to reduce the size of the tumor. Well, it turns out that COX-2 causes or stimulates angiogenesis, which is critical to local tumor growth, as well as metastasis. COX-2 regulates, primarily it disrupts apoptosis, so it disrupts programmed cell death, so these cancer cells don't die. And when you look in human medicine, and now Time Magazine is getting in on it, this was one of their statistics I pulled out. 28% is the percentage drop in the occurrence of ovarian cancer in women who regularly take non-steroidals, such as Advil or Aleve. The risk was decreased by as much as 37% with aspirin. So if you're not taking your aspirin a day, I would do it. Every tumor type that has been looked at least soft tissue tumor type, has marked upregulation of COX-2, so much so that there's some footwork looking at using COX-2 to prognosticate the success of therapy or the success of surgery. We're not quite there yet. What is the clinical implication here? Well, if you are using piroxicam because you believe that it is effective for, at least not totally effective, but helpful in controlling cancer, doesn't have to be piroxicam. In dogs, piroxicam is not a COX-1 protective drug. I'd use a COX-1 protective drug. It'll probably be safer, and it should presumably be more effective. In cats, I don't know. Nobody's really studied what's COX-1 versus COX-2 in cats, but any of them should, and that means if you're trying to control cancer pain, it makes perfect sense to me that part of the therapy should be a COX-1 protective non-steroidal, because that might help prevent metastasis. Eventually, what we're probably going to see in human medicine is not using the non-steroidals as part of combination anti-cancer therapy, but more as a preventative. And so I think we'll probably see some information about that. The only thing that I'm going to tell you is if you are using this in an animal to control pain, and that animal is also getting anti-cancer chemotherapy, remember, it's really subject now to GI toxicity, because the anti-cancer therapy is going to prevent epithelialization, and now you've removed the protective prostaglandin as well, so be careful. All right, well, let's shift gears now. If we leave COX-1 alone, will we make these drugs very safe? So hopefully I've convinced you that COX-2 is the guy to target. Now I need to convince you that leaving COX-1 alone is good enough. And the answer is, not quite. Certainly in the gastrointestinal tract, COX-1 is very important to protection. It is responsible for secretion of hydrochloric acid, controlling that. It is responsible for bicarbonate secretion, epithelialization, mucosal blood flow. All these are good things. But here's the kicker. As soon as there is any damage in the gastrointestinal tract, any damage at all, it should make perfect sense that COX-2 is going to become important. It's the inducible prostaglandin. If there needs to be GI healing, COX-2 is probably going to modulate it. What is the implication to you? Well, if you've got any kind of GI damage, then you need to be very careful having any drug on board that impairs COX-2. And just as an aside, if you're dealing with chronic inflammatory bowel disease, our drug of choice are glucocorticoids, and glucocorticoids target COX-2 more than COX-1. So it's one of the reasons that if you are treating chronic inflammatory bowel disease with steroids, as you should do, you need to have anti-secretory drugs and other gastroprotective drugs on board to help that GI tract heal. And people, they've demonstrated within 1 hour of infection of Helicobacter pylori, there will be induction of COX-2. So COX-2 is important for healing. Discontinue any drug that targets COX-2 if you have GI ulceration or erosion. But there's one more implication, and I got to thinking, okay, well, you know, healing is healing. It's inducible no matter what. What about other healing? So I did a little bit of reading, and it turns out that in the bone, COX-2 prostaglandins are particularly important for healing. In fact, in this one study that I'm going to show you here, in dogs that had fractures caused, half of the dogs received PGE2 and half did not. And those half, the half that got PGE2 had much more rapid healing compared to those animals that did not. So that study suggests that PGE2 is very important to healing of the bone. But what was a little bit more problematic or a little bit scarier was a study that was done in rats. They caused fractures in these rats, and then they gave these rats for 4 weeks either no nonsteroidal or a traditional nonsteroidal, ibuprofen, or a COX-1 protective nonsteroidal, Vioxx. And what they found is those animals that didn't receive anything had no malunions. But those animals that received nonunions, but those animals that received ibuprofen, 20% of them developed a nonunion. Scarily, that's a terrible adjective, disconcertingly, those animals that received Vioxx, those rats that received Vioxx, 70% of those rats developed a nonunion. So what does that mean to you as a clinician? Well, I would be worried if I had a bone that I anticipated was going to be a problem as far as healing. And I would be very careful using these drugs long term in that scenario. Short term maybe, but long term I'd be careful. What about the skin? Well, the studies have demonstrated that routine healing, such as a skin incision, is probably not going to be impacted by the nonsteroidals. But once again, if you have a chronic inflammatory or chronic wound that you're having difficulty trying to heal, I probably would be careful using the nonsteroidals long term. At the very least, what I would do is try and minimize my dose as much as possible so I didn't have much impairment on board. And I'd be thinking about combination analgesic therapy. All right, what about the kidney? That's the second major organ that is targeted by nonsteroidals, at least that we're aware of. Well, it turns out that both COX-1 and COX-2 are constitutively expressed in most species. We know that the prostaglandins have very many important roles in the kidney. For example, COX-1 is responsible for redistribution of blood flow from the cortex, where it's really not that needed, to the medulla, where it's going to be critically needed during states of hypotension, because the medulla, which is very active, very metabolically active, needs the oxygen, needs the blood flow. In contrast, COX-2 is largely responsible for making sure that sodium and water are in the urine, so it is responsible for maintaining urine flow. In human medicine, they've pretty much acclimated themselves to the fact that these newer classes of drugs are not any safer to the kidneys compared to the older class of drugs. So what that means to you is that if you worried about nonsteroidals in the kidney before, you still need to worry about it. From a clinician standpoint, that means that if you have a normal, healthy animal, you probably don't have to worry about things very much, even in the perioperative period. And I think that drug companies that have approved injectable products have demonstrated that. But in the patient at risk, the geriatric patient, the patient that undergoes a hypotensive episode on the surgical table, the patient with cardiovascular disease, the patient receiving nephroactive drugs, those are the patients I think that you need to be very careful with using a nonsteroidal perioperatively. What are nephroactive drugs? Certainly diuretics, aminoglycosides, because they impair renal prostaglandins, amphotericin B, because they impair renal blood flow, ACE inhibitors, because they alter the kidney's ability to autoregulate. These are all classes of drugs I'd be very careful with in animals that are receiving nonsteroidals. If you have a patient at risk, volume replace that animal about the time that you're going forward in surgery with a sodium-containing fluid, and that will hopefully reduce the risk of nephrotoxicity. As I alluded to before, I'm very worried about the cat. Those cats that have high normal BUNs and creatinines, I would assume that they're on their way to renal disease and probably would be very careful using nonsteroidals in those animals. Hemostasis is a wonderful example of the complex intricacy characterizing the interaction of prostaglandins. We've known for a long time that the traditional nonsteroidals increase the risk of bleeding, especially aspirin. It irreversibly acetylates thromboxane. Well, we also know that Vioxx increases the risk of stroke, and I've been warning veterinarians for a number of years that that's probably going to be true. Why? Well, if you look at hemostasis, there are two things that go on with hemostasis. As you sit here, you're making little holes in your capillaries, and your platelets are coming along, and they're seeing that hole, and they're going, oh my gosh, there's a hole I've got to repair, and so they aggregate. And when they aggregate, they attract more platelets that join the club, and they aggregate as well. Pretty soon you have a nice little clot or thrombus, you have some local vasoconstriction, you stop bleeding. The problem is that will keep continuing on. And if you don't stop it, then the thrombus will grow and get bigger, and eventually it will break off, become an embolus, and get the patient or you in trouble. Well, the body's pretty cool. What it's done is it's made sure that the more endothelial damage that is associated with that clot, the more prostacyclin is going to be released. And so as that clot gets bigger and bigger, the endothelium gets damaged, prostacyclin is released. Well, it does just the opposite. It inhibits thrombosis, and it causes local vasodilation. That way, we make sure our little thrombi don't become big thrombi and emboli. The problem is that the platelet aggregation is mediated by COX-1. Prostacyclin is mediated by COX-2. And if you come along with a COX-1 sparing drug and target primarily COX-2, what you're going to do is remove the inhibition, and you're going to allow this clot to go on and grow unchecked. We've known for a long time that glucocorticoids increase the risk of pulmonary thromboembolism. Animals with Cushing disease have an increased risk, and I think one of the reasons why is this. Glucocorticoids will impair prostacyclin. It removes the inhibition for thrombosis, setting the patient up for thromboembolic disease. So what does that mean to you as a clinician? Well, this is a perfect example, this in the kidney, of why it scares me to walk through ICU and see these animals with metabolic diseases or trauma receiving nonsteroidals, because I don't think we have a clue of what we're doing with the nonsteroidal and the body's ability to try and regulate. So I would be careful. Now, nicely, dogs don't suffer from too many thromboembolic diseases, but what does come to mind is the animal with heartworm disease, and maybe the animal with Cushing's disease. Cats suffer from thromboembolic disease, especially associated with cardiomyopathy, but the problem is we don't know which of these drugs are COX-1 sparing and which aren't. And until somebody actually studies that, we're going to be a little bit more handicapped. But once we figure that out, the cat with aortic thrombosis, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, I would just be careful with nonsteroidals in these animals. All right, just when we thought we had everything down, a new cyclooxygenase isoform has emerged, and it's been labeled COX-3, but it turns out it probably isn't a new isoform. It's probably just a variant of COX-1. But it came about because of acetaminophen. Acetaminophen is a great analgesic, it's a great antipyretic, but it's not a particularly good anti-inflammatory, and it doesn't target all the prostaglandins. So, turns out, targets a variant of COX-1. What's that mean to you? Well, it means that there may be a whole new class of drugs. Acetaminophen is not the safest drug in the world. There may be a whole new class of drugs that are like acetaminophen in the mechanism of action, but don't cause hepatic necrosis or the methemoglobinemia. We're not there yet, but that may be on the horizon. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to talk just a little bit about how these drugs behave in the animal, because that does give us grief. Most of these drugs, and we're going to drop down here, I'm going to talk just a little bit about protein binding. All of these drugs are highly protein bound, 99% protein bound. That means 1% of the dose that you give causes the pharmacologic response. Well, so what? The dose is designed to account for that. Well, the problem is if you make that drug now 98% protein bound, you've doubled the free form of the drug, the pharmacologic active form of the drug. And that's not that hard to do, to displace so that you're now 98% protein bound. When I was in school, I was told that's a problem, but I'm going to tell you it's probably not a problem, because that unbound drug is now going to be cleared more rapidly, and so it probably won't be a problem. The exception will be patients at risk. If your clearance organs are not functioning normally, then you might see a problem because of protein binding problems. So the patient with liver disease, maybe the cat, I'm not really sure. Otherwise, this high protein binding is not that big a deal. What is a big deal is hepatic metabolism. All of these drugs undergo hepatic metabolism. Some of these drugs, not all of them, have a longer half-life than the cat. That we know. But it goes much deeper than that. It turns out that most of these drugs are enantiomers. And now what we're going to do is we're going to delve into second-year chemistry. Remember when you were in organic and they talked about stereoisomers? Remember all those things? They were mirror images of one another, and we kind of blew it all off. There are D and L forms of amino acids. Well, it turns out that many of our drugs are actually marketed as stereoisomers. They're racemic mixtures, meaning 50% of one isomer and 50% of another. Many of our cardiac drugs, most of our nonsteroidals are. So what's the big deal? Well, it looks like the same drug, but as far as the body's concerned, it's two different drugs. And in fact, the example that I'm going to use here is carprofen. It is the S isomer that is anti-inflammatory, the R isomer that is analgesic. We're going to talk about COX-1, COX-2 ratios in just a couple of minutes. It is the S isomer that is specific for COX-2 compared to the R isomer. And it is the S isomer that undergoes enterohepatic circulation. Now, what does that mean to you as a clinician? Well, you know, that's a lot of stuff to have to learn. And people, they call this a chiral jungle out there. And I don't think that you need to learn it, but what you do need to appreciate is you should not extrapolate these drugs from one species to another. And even within species, we're going to have problems. Why? Well, Greyhounds are a good example. These guys are an enigma. We've known they've got problems with metabolism of anesthetics because of the redistribution issues, but it's not just that. I think these guys have weird livers as well. They do not handle Celebrex well at all, and there are probably other nonsteroidals that they don't handle well. In fact, in human medicine, they've characterized what are called poor metabolizers and efficient metabolizers of many drugs, including nonsteroidals. And this goes back to cytochrome P450. It's a class of drug metabolizing enzymes. Well, there are ethnic differences in how people handle these drugs. An example are African Americans don't handle them the same way as Asians, which don't handle them the same way as Caucasians. And it turns out we have the same problem in dogs as well. One study has demonstrated using beagle dogs, and one could argue if they are dogs that represent the rest of dogs, and I recognize that, but if this is true in beagle dogs, it's probably true in other species as well. There are efficient metabolizers of Celebrex, and there are poor metabolizers of Celebrex. And when you look at the peak plasma drug concentration between the poor and the efficient metabolizers, it's almost twofold higher. Okay, so what's that mean to you as a clinician? Well, it should not shock you at all that this dog over here handles these drugs absolutely wonderfully, and this dog over here has a disaster with these drugs. There are going to be, I'm convinced, within breed differences of these drugs and probably across breed differences of these drugs, and it's all the more reason in my mind to watch these animals and counsel these clients very, very well about reactions to these drugs. And we'll talk about most of that in the second session. So, I anticipate that there is going to be a class of patients that are going to be predisposed to toxicity that you have no idea because you don't know what their liver is doing. Now, there's also going to be a bunch of patients that are predisposed. They're patients at risk, and you will be able to identify them. And you'll be able to identify them because they're going to be species that are predisposed to longer half-lives, and they're going to be age extremes that have livers that don't function as well or livers that don't protect themselves as well. For these patients, the patients with liver disease, renal disease, GI disease, we need to be extra careful. And this is just a list of some of the things that they've done in people to be careful with these drugs. What I'm going to focus on is the use of anti-secretory drugs. Now, before I make that statement, though, if you do have a client that insists on using aspirin, or if you take aspirin, you need to take a buffered aspirin if you take full strength. Every time you take a full strength, unbuffered aspirin, you bleed about 5 mils into the GI tract. Aspirin is terrible on the GI tract. If you can get a client to use a new nonsteroidal, then one of the best things that you can do to prevent ulceration is to prevent gastric acid secretion. You have lots of options to do that. What I'm going to suggest is to use famotidine. Why? Well, because famotidine, unlike omeprazole and cimetidine and to some degree ranitidine, does not inhibit drug metabolizing enzymes. And my concern is if you use omeprazole, which is wonderful for controlling gastric acid secretion, it does inhibit drug metabolizing enzymes. And I'm afraid that if you do that, you'll increase the half-life of these drugs so that you do get yourself in a toxicity situation. So if you are preventing gastric acid secretion, I would use famotidine. On the other hand, if you are treating a patient that already has an ulcer formed and you're discontinuing the drugs, then I would use omeprazole because it is the more effective anti-secretory drug. The other things that you can do, well, use misoprostol. You'll be replacing that which you removed with the nonsteroidal. And in patients at risk, the geriatric patient, the patient on a high dose, just use misoprostol. The other thing that you can do is use sucralfate. Now, the sucralfate will not prevent the ulcer from forming. Sucralfate works by binding to damaged epithelium. So the epithelium's got to be damaged, the erosion's got to be there for sucralfate to work. But If the drug is there and the erosion does occur, it's already there and it will help protect the patient. And it turns out that sucralfate stimulates local prostaglandin production. It also scavenges oxygen radicals that help form the ulcer. So sucralfate's a pretty cool little drug. Okay, that's our first session. Now when we come back, and I'll answer your question in just a second, when we're going to come back, what we're going to do is we're actually going to take these drugs, the drugs that are approved for use in animals, and we're going to kind of, not tear them apart, but we're going to look at these drugs and compare safety information and to some degree efficacy information. Yes, there was a question? On dogs or cats that are that have IBD that you are using glucocorticoids for, is your question, what would I use up here to protect the patient? Famotidine and then sucralfate. That's what I would have those animals on. I would, as long as they're on, as long as they've got GI damage and you are giving them a drug that targets COX-1, and I'm sorry, COX-2, cyclooxygenases, I would have them on that.
Is there a limit?
Is there a limit to how long you can use
sucralfate?
Not sucralfate, and there's not a limit to how long you can use the anti-secretory drug, but here's the deal. If you have an animal that's on an anti-secretory drug, and this is true anytime you use a drug long-term, and I kind of implied it in the last session, the body gets used to that drug being there. If you stop an anti-secretory drug suddenly, well, the body's been putting out gastrin like crazy to try and get that pH back down, so you're going to have a hypergastrinemia on board, and if you stop the anti-secretory drug suddenly, then you're probably going to have a rebound hypersecretion. And so if once you do stop the famotidine or the omeprazole, I would taper it, much the same as I would taper glucocorticoids. Yes, sir?
Are you saying that aspirin does not have a place in
the clinic? Am I saying that aspirin doesn't? I think, you want my opinion? I'm going to get an opinion here. I do not think that aspirin has a place for control of inflammation in clinical medicine, not in veterinary medicine, not for control of inflammation. Now, we'll see that, and hopefully I'll convince you of that in the next session. Clients are still going to, the caveat is if they're going to refuse to do anything, then it is better than nothing, maybe. You just have to be very careful. It is not a good drug for controlling inflammation, despite the fact that we've used it for so long so successfully. We just have too many good drugs now. It's a dangerous drug, and we'll see that in the next session. Other questions? Okay, how long do we have before we start?
15 minutes,
okay. 4:40. See you hopefully in 15 minutes.